I'll just say that this is a continuation of the interview with Cal Kramer on October the 7th.
So that's why we thought about doing it this way. And we never got a permit to build because we knew nobody would approve it. The regulatory people couldn't, they just had it set in their mind that this is the way a camp was supposed to be built, and they were very dangerous. And so we built this kitchen, and we had then some sleeping quarters around, and we asked that no smoking be in the sleeping quarters, and took all the fire possibilities out. We tried to take all the radios and everything out too, but that didn't work. And so we ended up rewiring them in a safe way so that they could use a radio and so forth, reasonably safe in them. But we tried to even eliminate that fire hazard, and it didn't work. And then of course, one of the things that the state required was that there be a hammer type fire alarm outside the cabins, and it could be in a central place. And we says, why do you want that? Well, that's what the law says. We says, well, we know there's smoke alarms available now. That's what we would like to put in, because if a cabin starts on fire, well, we would really like those guys to get out before it kills them, you know. And the smoke alarm makes a whole lot more sense than that dang central alarm that you're talking about, because the other people aren't in danger that are going to be in the other cabins. Well, the regulations never allowed that, and they says, but the Mexicans always pull the batteries
on the smoke detector.
Yeah, on the smoke detector. So we went ahead and put smoke detectors in the cabins, and we always put two in, and we tried to put them beyond the reach of the Mexicans. And we did follow their regulations and put that out. But we've done some of those kind of things. We don't get an inspection from the state no more. They inspected us once. They says, well, you're so far in advance of the state on what a housing should be that we don't even have to inspect you.
The situation is that these are migrant worker populations, then.
Yes.
People that don't have a place to live here in the area.
Right, and we've always stuck with men only.
Uh-huh.
Never have had any women. Now that is changing, because we've helped two families already get their families up here. The law now allows for families to come in legally, and we've been working with INS, and INS has a person out here whose job it is to take those that want to become permanent residents in the area to be able to get their families up here. And we've done two. We've got two more pending. And in those situations, well, we have to help them get housing and you have to guarantee them a job and a few things like that.
This is permanent housing?
Yes.
How did you pick the families, or did they sort of select themselves?
They select themselves, yeah.
Yeah. Someone comes to you and says, I'd like to bring my family up.
You got to remember that we've got a bunch of guys out here. They're almost all related, all from the same place.
Oh, yeah.
And we've got a few rules, no drunkenness. You can have beer, and you can drink it reasonably, and no drugs, and a few of those things, see? So those guys, they won't let a druggie in camp.
Uh-huh.
And
so they turn them in to you? Or
we don't allow them a bed.
Uh-huh.
And they tell us who they are, and we don't allow them a bed. Mm-hmm. And,
do you think it's information you can rely on, or is it possible just clannish behavior that they might, be trying to do?
I don't know how else to go to get it. It may be discriminatory in some aspects, but I don't know how else to do it. I don't speak the language, and none of the rest of us speak it hardly at all. My one son took 2 years in high school or something like that, and he doesn't speak it too well. But with the abilities we got, well, we have been able to control it fairly well.
And you haven't had too much trouble along those lines with drugs or alcohol?
No. Now, we have had with the union, and they all, every now and then they try to plant somebody in our crew. And of course, we had a big strike a year ago, and there was three or four guys that came in here, and they threatened the rest of them that they'd beat them up if they went out and went to work. And it took a little bit of going around, and we ended up with about six attorneys in the place, and from legal aid, and one guy from the union, and so we was able to pull a pretty good deal and walked all our guys out from under them and out into the field and wouldn't let them out in the field.
The union ones, you mean, or what?
The three or four that were union, they did go to the field because they didn't want to be identified.
And now, who were the ones that they didn't let in the field then?
There was legal aid, and then there was a union representative with legal aid. And, of course, legal aid is a government agency, and I don't agree with what they did at all. I mean, that was crooked as hell.
Yeah, well, tell me a little bit more about that.
Well, the three or four guys that had come into the group and then had threatened to beat them up if they went to work were also in contact with legal aid and with the union. And
so it was an intimidation kind of tactic?
Yes, it was.
To try to get everybody to go out on strike?
Yes, it was. Uh-huh. And, of course, the year before, we had paid a penny a pound more than they had down south, which would be the Salem area. Mm-hmm. And we were going to pay the same thing this last year. Well, then they decided they wanted to pay any more. That was how the union was going to try to get the strike. Well, really, the union wanted to get on the farm. They weren't interested in they didn't give a darn about the pickers. And so one of the thing we did was we didn't tell them. We just told the workers, okay, you got your penny, come on with us. And they walked right with us. They didn't tell them nothing. They just walked out from way. Uh-huh. Went with us out into the field.
So you gave them the penny that the union was trying to get for them anyway.
Yeah, but we didn't let the union on the farm.
And so you've been with the non-union workforce all these years?
Yes.
And they were just trying to get in?
And through intimidation.
Mm-hmm. And that was last year?
Yes.
Okay, I had the impression that maybe it had been going on longer than that, but I guess...
No, that was that effort, and it was the effort down south, and this year there hasn't been any problem, and of course the union is about broke and about out of business.
Is your farm, what were you going to say just now? Is your farm typical of other farms in the valley then? Is it all a non-unionized workforce for the most part?
Yes. Yes, it's all. The only thing that's unionized, how the union got started was with a tree planting, with the corporations, the timber corporations, and the timber corporations hired a contractor, and then there was a couple contractors that ripped off their help, and didn't pay them. And of course, yes, workers should be protected from that kind of situation.
But you don't think that the answer is a union that applies to all workers, agricultural workers out here?
Well, I'm not non-union. I just haven't found a union that has that's honest and reasonable. And you know, I believe that there are some unions in the United States, and there could be in this situation, that could be a real help to the producer and to the help, and be very cooperative with them all, and see to it that the help is available, and do those kind of things. See, but that isn't what they're interested in. All the union wants to do is to take some money from somebody so that they can sit around and operate. They aren't interested in helping anybody.
You mentioned that you think there are some unions. Are there specific ones that you...
No, I don't have any specific ones, but I have heard of some, and I've never retained the names. I've got a friend who was in the timber industry, and he was a union person, and his greatest pride was is that his union never was off a day, and he was always able to provide a good wage for his help, and he was always able to help the employer. So, and that's what I'm talking about. We, you know, if those guys had, they've never came to us and talked to us and asked us if we'd like to be unionized. All they want to do is strike. I mean, if they can't make a big deal out of it, well, they're not interested.
So they've never come to negotiate with you?
No.
Why do you think they picked your farm? Of all the farms that they might have picked to strike in the valley?
I guess I don't know. Yeah, they may have thought it might have been easy to pick, but it wasn't.
They thought you might have been an easy first challenge or something.
Well, see, Kramer Farms in Mount Angel they've been on struck them now for 3 years.
Oh, now maybe that's what I'm confusing you with.
Yes.
It's a different Kramer then.
Yes. Yeah, they don't even know how to spell Kramer. But they are Norpak growers also.
I see. Okay, that's the confusion. See, I thought it was your operation that had been the target of this longer strike.
No, we're the quiet Kramers. We're trying to stay quiet.
Okay, I see.
Yes, and that's a bad deal too. That's more of an example of what I've been talking about.
The other Kramer.
Yeah, they've got a very nice living quarters. They handle their help real good. And their help makes money. They've never lost a pound of strawberries or a head of broccoli because of the union. Their help is with them, staying with them, working with them. There's pickets out on the road, and their employees just bypass them.
So their employees don't support the strike then?
No.
And that was the same union, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And so they were down there, and then they decided to move on you last year.
Oh, wherever there was maybe an opportunity. Mm-hmm. And of course, these three or four guys that were here in this crew came out of California from Chavez's groups. And of course, Chavez's groups are about dead in California. There's hardly anything going down there anymore. They thought they were going to be able to stay pretty quiet, you know, and as soon as it was over here, well, through a means of elimination, we figured out who it was real quick. And we didn't fire them, but as soon as they left, well, there was no way they were going to get a job back.
These are the three that helped. Yeah, helped out last year.
Yeah.
Now, with respect to the other Kramer, then the longer strike, Has the tactics of the Union been the same, do you know, in that situation?
Yes.
No, no negotiation with them or conversation between the Union? Oh, and,
now I don't know that.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you said that one of the things you mentioned that was a plus on both your farm and the other Kramer's farm were the living quarters. Can you describe sort of what the quarters are like and how they they're better, say, maybe than the average run-of-the-mill quarters that are provided for workers?
I'm not saying mine are better than the average. I'm just saying we have a different style of living quarters that we feel make it safer. Problems. Refrigerators were always a problem. When you got to single cabin, well, you got to, they buy an old used refrigerator, put it in there, and pretty soon it quits. And where we've got a centralized kitchen, well, we've got a walk-in cooler, and each employee's got a basket, and he can lock it if he wants to. I've never seen a lock on one yet. And the central cooling system is easier to maintain, and it always goes. And we, a lot of those camps had originally set up with flush toilets in the septic field, and they were nothing but a headache. They were always plugged up. And as you know, there's a cultural thing here with the toilets that is different. You know, in Mexico, well, they don't put no paper down the toilet. They wipe themselves and then put the paper in the wastebasket. And so because of those cultural differences, it makes it harder to maintain a flush-type system. Mm-hmm. So we went with the chemical toilets, and they're pumped as often as needed. And when we've got a full crew in, well, he's in here twice a week. When at this time of the year now, we've only got a few guys there, or half a dozen, well, he comes once a week. But but it's certainly a lot easier to maintain than the flush ones were. And that was a real problem for those guys that had those. That's where the inspectors always got them, because there was one plugged up all the time.
Right, so anytime the inspector would walk in, he'd find something wrong.
Right. And like the screening and stuff like that, well, it's been really quite easy to screen our kitchen because of design. And of course, then it kind of eliminates the real need for screening of the rest of the quarters.
Now you mentioned that you passed state inspections without any difficulty, but that you didn't apply for a permit to build your facilities in the beginning. So you can get away with that, with building without the permit?
We did.
Okay.
I've built a few buildings, and they've tagged them. And that tag is red, but you know, after time, well, it turns white.
So there's not real heavy enforcement then on the building permit in that situation?
No, that's not true. There was a law that in the EAFU zone, well, you didn't have to have a permit to build a farm building, only a house.
Ah, I see.
And we didn't know where a kitchen fit in, whether it was for a permit or not, but we were pretty sure that they would want to tell us how we were supposed to build it then. And we decided that it was enough different from anything that they deal with that they weren't going to be able to tell us anything anyhow. And so we went ahead and built it. It meant that we couldn't, we had to run the electrical power from another building rather than directly from the pole. And of course it had to have three phase because there was a cooler in it, and which we had three phase in the shop anyhow, and so we did that. We didn't get any outside financing from the banks, or we could have got a grant from the state, and we didn't go try to do that because we felt that if we did that, well, they would probably put enough restrictions on it that there wasn't any money in it anyhow. So, but we did tell a couple of state inspectors what we were doing, and they were the health inspectors, and they kind of agreed with us, and so then we went ahead and did it then.
So you had a little bit of sanction then from
that court. Now,
you had mentioned when we started this conversation labor that you said you hired a wino. Was that it?
Well, in the 1960s, Wygant's over at Canby took an old lumber carrier and made a picking machine out of it for raspberries and blackberries that were on wire. And it was quite successful, and so Hudson House bought them, and then they rented them out to the farmers. And so Don Jesse and I rented three of them then, and we run them in the Tualatin Valley and as far south as McMinnville, custom picking black caps and raspberries and blackberries. And we usually start with black caps about the 1st of July, and we run till mid-September with those, picking evergreen blackberries. And we thought that was a coming thing, and it was. And of course, the raspberries are practically all picked by machine now, and the black caps all are.
How does the machine work? It just shakes them off?
Yes, it shakes them off, and they have to be ripe, and it shakes them off. And depending on the fruit as to how often you pick. If it's raspberries, you pick twice a week. If it's blackberries, you pick once a week.
So you just go through and shake the vines, and then the ones that fall off are the ripe ones, huh?
Right, and they fall into a belt, and then they're transferred to the top of the machine, and there's a sorting belt there, and you can put four people on the sorting belt to throw out junk. And then they go into crates, and on the iron wino, that all went to the top, and it would hold a pallet of empties and then another pallet that you could put the full ones on. And that's usually 60 crates, so it's quite a bit of weight. And of course, we had them several years, and over the years, well, they improved them. They made them leveling and stuff like that, that the old ones weren't, that you could use them on a hillside. And so, we never rolled one, but we sure came close a few times.
So it's just an effective way to pick berries.
Yes. We did a lot of research with it. Oregon State researched a lot of aspects of it. And one time they put a freeze tunnel on it so that they IQF'd them as they came across the belt.
IQF'd them?
That's individually frozen.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, the only thing is it froze the bugs, too.
And then they go right into some sort of bulk frozen package.
Right, the insulated box.
And so now, I misunderstood you earlier. I thought you said you'd hired a wino, but you said it's the iron wino?
Iron wino is what it was called. And Of course, now the Iron Wino is not in existence, but there is one machine built at Staten, one in Michigan, one in Sweden. Those three, I think, are used in this area now. Mm-hmm. I have seen the Iron Wino in Hawaii, where they tried to pick coffee with it. Mm-hmm. Told them I didn't think it would work, and I never stayed around long enough to find out if it did. But they're used all over now. And, of course, in Michigan, well, they use them on blueberries also. And we have a couple machines in Northwest Oregon that picks blueberries with them. They pick blueberries with them.
Okay, the other thing I guess I was going to ask you about was, have you ever had any really bad years since you went to the row crops?
Oh, yes. Oh, 1 year, the most we've lost is $100,000 one year.
Wow.
Yeah. Well,
that must have been a tough year.
Yeah, it was a tough year. And we've lost several times since then, and we've made $100,000.
So it's a game of averages, it sounds like.
Yes. Yes.
And in the years that you suffered losses, the main problems, I suppose, are weather. Is that right? Or
yes. Mm-hmm. Weather was always the problem. Then try, and the next problem is trying to get the bank stick with you one more year so you can come out of the hole.
And is that a problem for a farm like yours that's been in business for a while?
Oh, yes.
Really?
Yes.
Even if you've had a track record?
Yeah, because you always, they change bankers every 2 or 3 years. And we started out with Forest Grove National. Then it went to U.S. Then we ended up in the bank out of Idaho. And then it merged with Bank of Hawaii. And now it's called Pacific One. This has all gone on in the last 6 years.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I was a bit confused by Pacific One the other day. I was out in Forest Grove and didn't realize that that it was formerly the Bank of America, you said?
No, it was West One.
West One, okay. Yeah, which was formerly something else, I guess. Yeah.
And see, West One didn't have a farm loan officer up here, but they wanted to do farm business. And it left us a little bit of a problem. And of course, U.S., well, we had a couple of bad years, and they didn't know what they wanted to do with us. And finally, we told them, well, we owe you some money. We'll pay you when we get it. And we don't want any of your other money. And they says, okay. So the next year, we had a real good year. We paid them all off and says, goodbye. And we went to... Then West One come along and says, gee, we'd like to have you, you know. Well, then West One sold the U.S. And then in that merger, well, then U.S. couldn't take all the banks, so they sold their surplus banks to Pacific One or Hawaii.
So, yeah, it's... Well, I guess.
So the continuity is not the farm, it's in the bank.
Right. I see, yeah. I know my own home mortgage has been sold a few times to the various banks, but in my case, of course, doesn't make much difference. But in your case, I can see where it would make a difference. You don't have that continuing relationship. And what kind of debt does a farm your size carry on the average?
$250,000.
That's a substantial little piece of money.
Mm-hmm.
And your crop mix has changed not too much over the years then? I guess you mentioned that you took out the blackberries and put in more...
They've changed, but not too much. And of course, the boys are changing all the time too. And, you know, with a 10% ownership and limited partnership, well, I'm not much involved in the management anymore. But, you know, I criticize, and I, that's my right. I've been around long enough.
Do you have any real real differences with
your partners? Oh, yes, we have some differences. This year they're planting practically all cover crop and no wheat. And
you think that's probably not a, that's a mistake?
Well, then it means that they have to plant too much sweet corn, and I don't believe there's any money in sweet corn.
Ah, I see.
See, and I never raised much sweet corn in my day. I'd raised maybe 20 or 30 acres. And of course, they're clear up to 80 acres with this stuff. And I always used it for rotation on the bottom ground where I couldn't raise wheat, but I always raised wheat on the up ground where I could rotate. Because wheat was a crop that I could handle. I could do the work, but it didn't interfere with the row crops. And I concentrated on the row crops, and that was my crops.
And but, you think that they're a little more profitable than the...
Oh, yes. They're a lot more profitable. And so that's where I have my differences with the boys right at the moment is... They aren't concentrating enough on the profitable stuff and screwing around with this non-producing stuff.
And what's their defense? What do they argue?
They don't.
They know better than to argue with the old man. Okay. Well, I'm sort of. You've done a good job of describing the farming operation. Is there any other aspect of it, though, that we haven't talked about that we might spend a minute or two on?
Well, as far as good, wholesome food, and that's what our job is now, is producing good, wholesome, clean food, healthy food. And that's really... what our effort is to do. It is not to just produce something that we can get paid for. It is something that's healthy and people can feel confident to eat, and it's not going to affect them health-wise or anything like that. All the pesticides we use is recommended by a consultant, and that's his specialty job. The processor has their field men, they have their recommendations that we can use, and our consultant, his recommendations are within the processor's recommendations. Everything is written and recorded, and the pertinent information is kept, and that information is turned in with the first load that's delivered to the processor. The processor won't allow us to dump that load unless that information is with it. And so the regulatory people, if they want to make a pesticide check of that load, they can go right to that and they can tell just exactly what they need to check for. There's such a wide variety of pesticides that if they had to shoot for trying to identify a pesticide without any knowledge ahead of time of what might have been used, well, it's very, very hard to hit. And so they know what to look for and whether it was, if there's a residue. The only thing wrong with the reporting thing is that if you do it wrong, you don't report it that way.
So sometimes they might not know what to look for, in other words.
They would probably know what to look for, but the volume that was used, you can always screw up in a tank, you know, and of pesticide. And if you get double the amount on, well, you aren't going to write it down that way. You're going to write down that you put it on, but you're going to write it down according to the label.
I see.
That's the only fallacy in it, but it's really a pretty good system, and the processor and the grower both make an effort to produce a good, healthy food. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And is that part of the joy of farming for you?
That's a part of the challenge, yes.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, I know, I mean, we've already, you mentioned a lot off tape about your own lifestyle and about how you live off the land. And
okay, well, I've got proof that I like to farm, and that I can transfer that feeling to a lot of other people, because I got three sons that are farmers. And if that isn't proof that I didn't do a good job of showing them how to farm and want to, well, I don't know what other proof there is.
Mm-hmm. And you eat yourself off of your own farm, too. You put up
Oh, yes.
A little bit of everything you grow here?
Oh, yes. Uh-huh. Yep. Most of the time we don't put up any corn because we can get it from the processor so cheap. That.
Uh-huh.
And the same thing with beans. We like beans out of a can, tin can. Got to have the taste of tin in it.
And do you have a special? You have a direct line to wholesale prices from the processor. Then is that how that works?
No, we can buy cheaper out of the store on sale prices.
Oh yeah, than you can from the processor.
Yes.
I guess that has to do with the way things are marketed. Huh?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks a lot, Cal, for describing your farming operation for me today. I guess we can call it a day with that.
Mm-hmm.
And thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.